Hello, hello, and a rather warm welcome to today's show. You're listening to Kevin Durgin here on UK Health Radio. Thank you so much for supporting Acupuncture Point. Coming up in today's show, we are going to meet a rather fantastic writer and director, an all-round good egg. His name is Giles Ramsay, and he has just written a brand new, rather fantastic book called The History of Theatre in 12 Lives.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello there, you're listening to Kevin Durgin here on UK Health Radio. We are your global feel-good station, available online via the UK Health Radio app and also via Alexa. Thank you so much for listening to this rather special edition of Acupuncture Point. Now, one of the things that I adore about presenting this show is that I get to meet with all sorts of marvellous people doing exciting work in their respective fields. And today, I'm extremely delighted to welcome to Acupuncture Point Mr. Giles Ramsay, who has just published his brand new book, A History of Theatre in 12 Lives, From Gods to Bad Boys. A very warm welcome, Giles Ramsay.
Hello, Kevin. Thank you very much for having me on the show. Lovely to see you.
Giles, I love the book. I love the book. Now, I've worked in theatre for so many years, and theatre is usually slightly dry, but this is a very moist and, dare one say it, fruity offering. It's very funny and also packed with information. Tell us a little bit more about your new book.
Oh, good Lord. Well, it is, as you say, a history of theatre in 12 lives. I thought rather than just going through it historically, we always find people more interesting than perhaps facts. And so I wanted to look at these great works of art through the prism of the artists who wrote them, but actually more particularly through the prism of the lives and the worlds they lived in at the time. One of my mantras in the book is that nothing comes from nothing, which goes right back to the ancients. And it's true. Everything you and I do and everything that anybody has ever done has a backstory about how it came about. And so did these wonderful playwrights and actors and producers who made the theatre over several thousand years what it is today. So I wanted to unravel a bit about their backstories and the worlds they came from.
Now, I'm reading through the back here. From Gods to Bad Boys examines the history of theatre from cave paintings all the way up to the swinging 60s. Now, I don't know about you, but when I think of theatre, I think about a gin and tonic in the interval. I think about velvet curtains. I do not usually think about cave paintings. How on earth do cave paintings come into the history of theatre?
I think when many of us think about theatre, we think about incredibly uncomfortable seats designed by spiteful architects with no legs. The modern theatre-going experience is very variable. I wanted to look at what motivated people to indulge in the arts from the very beginning. I mean, why does a playwright today, or why did dancers and singers and storytellers start taking it seriously thousands upon thousands of years ago? And don't forget, not everybody could do it. And one of the things I bang on about early in the book is about the rise of the experts. Some people could dance and imitate a buffalo better than others. Some people could actually stencil or paint cave paintings on a wall better than you and me. So they became the experts, the artists. And maybe there was lots of Neanderthal self-expression, but fortunately that's been lost. Why start with the cave paintings? It's because there's something about the essence of humankind. It's partly our need to mark our existence. And when people went into caves, not where they lived, in the darkness, and decided to paint a mark of their hand on the wall and then draw animals on the cave wall, there's quite a lot going on there. Yes, it's I was here, but it's also something about connecting with the rock, the permanency of rock and the fragility as clearly understood by Neanderthal men and women early on, but also connecting with the power of the animals that we hunted, buffalo, etc. And then we clothed ourselves in their skins. The earliest implements ever found made by men are needles, because it's one of the primary things we needed to survive, to stay warm, to wear early clothes. So I wanted to look at this connection of why, from the beginning, men and women felt the need to explain themselves to themselves through abstract forms of expression, not through literal forms of expression. We don't know what they literally discussed, but they chose to put abstract shapes, patterns, as I say, stencils of hands on walls. And sometimes it is the coming in from the left field, coming in from a different angle, that clarifies reality for us, whereas a scientific explanation or an historical explanation doesn't, it isn't enough. So Portia's The Quality of Mercy speech might tell us more about justice than years at law school. Sometimes something just very beautiful, simple, and allegorical can clarify rather than obscure.
That is beautiful, really, really beautiful. When I'm in my clinic and seeing patients, often I will talk to them not about, you know, health, specifically health-related things. Sometimes I'll say, here's a book. Why don't you read this book? Because in it, I'm hoping that there'll be, as you say, the essence of something possibly and potentially transformative. And
We were telling stories before we invented the wheel. And we need both. We need stories and wheels. But we were telling stories before we invented round objects we could travel on.
The 12 playwrights that you are that you've included in your book: Dionysus, Aeschylus, Everyman, Marlowe, Shakespeare, Aphra-Behn, Garrick, Wilde, George II, Rattigan, Baylis, and Orton. Now, this really is a greatest hits parade of the very best playwrights from around the world. Who did you most enjoy writing about, and why?
Oh, it's hard to be selective. And as any of your listeners who know about the theatre will recognise, that's not all playwrights. But let's put them down as influencers. They're primarily playwrights because really, until quite recently, modern theatre, and we can argue about that when that began, but was the writer's theatre. That was the name that dominated, whether it was Aeschylus or Shakespeare or Oscar Wilde. Nowadays, we've got much more variety of producers, directors, actors' theatre. Garrick was an actor, not a writer. Well, he did write some plays and some musicals, actually. So who did I like the most? It probably depended on where I was when I was writing it. Oscar Wilde is always fun to write about because, A, there's a lot of froth and wit in his life, but also a lot of depth and tragedy. So that was a rich chapter to research and then piece together. And I've looked a lot about his personal life because I think we know the playwriting story very well, but some of the things that inspired it. Why are his plays about secrets and lies and blackmail? Because quite simply, they're things he grew up with. He knew about them, not just for his life, but actually from his parents' life as well. His father had been quite a naughty boy in his time, and that brought out a great scandal when Oscar Wilde was a little boy. And these things mark us. Nothing comes from nothing. And so within the comedies of Wilde, there's an awful lot of serious autobiography lurking around as well. Other fun people, Christopher Marlowe is always fun because he was a spy for the espionage services against the Catholic causes during the reign of Elizabeth. So that's an interesting parallel, playwright, poet, and spy. I love Lillian Bayliss, who ran the Old Vic in the 20s. Well, she actually took it over from her aunt about 1912. And it's just she was clearly a tough old bird of the theatre who made things happen. So I'm going to not do a Desert Island Discs, if I may, and pick one. I want the whole party. I want everybody to be at the party, not just one or two.
There was a very, very lovely quote that I laughed out loud about Lillian Bayliss and actors approaching her for a pay rise. Charles, could you tell us that? Because it is particularly great.
Well, no, I mean, just Lillian Bayliss was a very religious woman, and she actually always claimed that she had started to put Shakespeare on the Old Vic because this is the Old Vic Theatre in London by Waterloo Station. And She always claimed she was motivated because in her sleep, once she was restless because she was stressed, and then a voice came to her and she was convinced it was God who told her, put Shakespeare on as you are doing with a dance company in the opera. So this very Christian woman used to be approached by the actors for a pay rise. And these are actors like Laurence Olivier, John Gielgud, Edith Evans, Michael Redgrave. So we're talking young actors who were going to become the greats, the gods of their own theatrical time. And they asked her for a pay rise because she was paying them nothing. And she just said, I'll go and ask God. And she went into her office, which was at the side of the stage. And then she just came back and said, God says no. And they all stuck with it. They all stuck with it simply because the commercial West End wasn't doing a lot of Shakespeare, wasn't economically viable. So if you wanted to learn how to be in classical plays and you were a young Edith Evans, Laurence Olivier, you had no choice. You went to the Old Vic and worked for virtually nothing.
I love that. I absolutely, absolutely love that. Now, Giles, this A History of Theatre in 12 Lives, From Gods to Bad Boys, it is your first ever book. How did you find the process of writing?
Horrible. I think that's anybody who's sat down and written an extended dissertation, thesis, essay, book, whatever. It's work. It really is. Now, I was lucky in that I've lectured on theatre for 20-odd years plus. And therefore, essentially, most of the research was done. And then I was in the rather lucky position. I lecture at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, but also on cruise ships crossing the Atlantic. And people kindly come up to you after a lecture and say, oh, do you have a book? I'd love to buy it. And I was in the ridiculous position. I had all the information, but I didn't have the book because I was too lazy to write it. And I'd be saying no. Whereas I'd watch other people trying to desperately sell the book they had published, but nobody wanted to buy it. So I thought it was probably, guess what, under lockdown, time to remedy this self-inflicted dilemma. And so very early on, actually, within the first few days of the first lockdown, I just thought, I've got to get this done because, and don't forget, we thought this was going to be a three-monther. Well, it's turned out to be almost a two-yearer. But I just thought at the end of whenever this comes to an end, I want to have something to show for sitting around at home for this length of time. And so it's time to sit down and it's the blank page and you just start writing. And then funnily enough, I started in the middle. I started with Marlowe and then went forward and then wrapped back to the beginning of the book with cave paintings and Dionysus and Aeschylus. And by the time I got back to Marlowe again, I realized that the chapters on Marlowe and Shakespeare were absolute garbage and had to be thrown in the dustbin. And then you start wrapping around and wrapping around. And so, yeah, I found it difficult. I found it very enjoyable, incredibly satisfying. And now it's done. I don't feel I've had a wasted 2 years. And so I suppose it's very important to set silly little targets sometimes and then actually hit them, because otherwise we kick ourselves, wasted opportunities.
I too joined your club, Giles, of writing a book during lockdown. So Delicious Mauritius is out now.
And what's that about, Kevin? What's that about?
That is a cookery book all about, funnily enough, Mauritian food. And I wrote it with my mum over lockdown. We would talk together over Zoom. My mum would recite the recipes, and then I would try my very, very best to type them up as fast as I possibly could. And it was really, really, really good fun initially. And then it turned into, this is real hard work. And I tried to curtail the amount of work by sending my finished manuscript to a very, very dear friend of mine who is a professional editor. And she edited it for me. And then when I got it back, I read it and it was great. But I felt that it wasn't my voice anymore. So then I had to repiece things and re-edit and go through everything, not just once, as I'd thought, but about four or five different times. It was hard work. But seeing the final image uploaded online really does make it worth it. I felt so excited.
I think that makes perfect sense. And also, you mentioned about finding your voice. the first voice I found on the page that I had wasn't mine or anybody I know's voice. It was trying too hard. There was something, I think I was subconsciously trying to be quirky and chatty. And we all know that quirky, chatty people are deeply annoying, and you move away from them at cocktail parties. And I just found these early chapters were very much, I want to look over their shoulder and go and talk to somebody else. And then now if I, you know, reading through for, you know, editing purposes, I found that there wasn't an overall annoying voice. And I hope that's what readers find. But maybe it's the same with life. Sometimes we create personas which aren't actually us, which aren't actually natural. And therefore, maybe we need to reinvent ourselves and rewrite ourselves occasionally just to get back to simplicity and the truth rather than putting on a razzle-dazzle show.
Gosh, wise words, Charles Ramsay. Wise words. Now, do you have any advice for wannabe writers, either of fiction or non-fiction?
Start. Absolutely start. And don't edit as you begin. Just plow on and get it all on the page. But then realize that whatever you've got is not the final draft. And maybe even after 2, 3, 10, 20 rereads and rewrites, you're still not done. But like a painting, I think there is a time to put your brush away, mostly because you'll just end up paying a copy editor to lay it out again and again if you keep adding another word here and another word there. There is a time to stop, but it sure isn't early on. You get going, get it all on the page, and then it's just a different level of work when you have to reassemble and be really self-critical and think, okay, I love that story, but it doesn't fit in. Or that's a really good bit of information, but it's only there because I want to show off. And it's about getting rid of stuff. You can always use it somewhere else. Maybe one of those boring cocktail parties. Everything you cut out your book, you can tell people at parties instead.
I remember reading something about the way in which Jeffrey Archer writes his books. And he would write them all out freehand, so he wouldn't use a laptop. He would write them out in exercise books by hand, and then he would rewrite them by hand at least 10 to 15 times before it was even ready, before it was even in any sort of shape. So I, you know, as a writer myself, I think that I would also agree we just need to keep going and don't put yourself off by pruning your creativity a little bit too soon. Charles, you are course leader of theatre at London's Victoria and Albert Museum. You are a theatre director. You have produced many theatrical productions, and also you set up, founded the charity Developing Artists, which exists to bring theatre to developing countries all around the world, specifically sub-Saharan Africa. Why does theatre matter to you?
It's live is the obvious answer, and it's nothing, you know, I love television, I love the movies, but there's something that we've noticed in the last 18 months plus, that with the theatres open, closed, the theatres, certainly in London, when they have been allowed to reopen, have been full. And that might be terribly scary to some people, but actually those who went, they made their choice. The health and safety guidelines were extremely clear. The theatres have worked terribly hard to increase ventilation, do the testing. You have to show your vaccine passports. You can't necessarily move freely to the bars, etc. So they've adapted. But coming back as a live audience, there's been a lot of sort of people nodding to each other, people actually talking to the person sitting next to them, which they wouldn't perhaps have done. We've all got a bit lazy. We had got a bit lazy. I think we are aware now of community and how much it matters to us. And I can be a terribly antisocial person, but it's quite fun to get in with a crowd of people and have a shared experience live in front of you. So I think that's one of the reasons theatre matters, in the same way that it mattered to gather together in that cave by firelight and watch paintings of buffalo run across the cave walls. So we need community, whether we like it or not. I think commercially, a lot of people make their living out of it. It is actually a job for people. And a lot of people 18 months ago lost their jobs overnight. It's not just the actors. It's not just the famous directors. It's the stagehands. It's the lighting technicians. It's the people who put the get in, have to just drive the lorries and lug great big bags of props and things into the theatre. They all lost their jobs. So it's an industry, it's a business, but it's also something a bit more spiritual, if I dare. So it's a team effort from start to finish. And I think that's what we all missed, is the assembling of it and then the enjoying it. I think we've missed it. It's back. It'll go away again, and then it'll come back again. Let's hope that is the way it works.
Giles, where can people find out more about you, your work, and your fabulous book, A History of Theatre in 12 Lives, From Gods to Bad Boys?
Thank you, Kevin. That's a marvellous plug. Much appreciated. Free copies in the post. The book's on Amazon. So just type in Giles Ramsay, Ramsay, and it will pop up between Giles Brandreth and the political writer Giles Radici. And then that will take you to the book. And it's available in paperback, ebook, and hardback. For the other stuff, the charity is called Developing Artists, and we're working on a wonderful project that's going to go to Nigeria and Zimbabwe, hopefully in 2022. And we're restaging Aeschylus's The Suppliant Woman. And The Suppliant Woman is about female refugees who come and claim asylum. And this story is as old as the hills, and the play is 2,500 years old, and it has a very punchy relevance to today, women and asylum, and the reaction to those in the mainland who are not necessarily always all welcoming. So we're going to work, and that's just been done in Canterbury, in Kent, and we're going to then develop it so that it can be done, including local communities as the chorus in Nigeria and Zimbabwe. And that's more or less, I think that's going to keep me busy. I'm working on an 18th century operetta as well, which is about robots, automata, 18th century style. So that'll be fun. And that's my project for January, February.
Giles Ramsay, author of A History of Theatre in 12 Lives, From Gods to Bad Boys. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us here on Acupuncture Point today.
Kevin, thank you very much for having me, and a happy Christmas to everyone.
Happy, happy Christmas. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Absolutely joyous was that. And on that rather festive note, thank you so much for joining me, Kevin Durgeon, here on UK Health Radio. It has been an absolute pleasure. See you again very soon. Goodbye.